Christine Leighton on Afternoons, ABC Radio Perth and WA, and on the ABC Listen app.
So Andrew Whitehouse is a professor of autism research at Telethon Kids Institute and the University of Western Australia. He has pioneered effective therapies for babies showing early signs of autism and led the development of Australia's first national guideline for autism diagnosis. The Eureka Prize winner is also regularly called on by the federal and state governments to inform autism policy. In 2021, he became the youngest ever fellow elected to the prestigious Australian Academy of Health and Medical Sciences. He is the president of the Australasian Society for Autism Research and has made time for all of you. Good afternoon, Professor.
G'day, Christine. How boring do I sound?
No, you sound very important, and for that reason, thank you for giving us 20 minutes of your time, because that is rather valuable.
Looking forward to it.
Good. All right. Well, let's start with the basics. Can you tell us exactly what autism is and the different types?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, autism is what we call a neurodevelopmental condition, which essentially just means that something happens early on in development to make the brain develop differently to what we typically expect. Now, we know that autism is caused by differences in the genetics, and genetics causes differences in how the brain develops. But we don't know enough about the genetics, and we don't know enough about the brain in relation to autism, so we diagnose based on behaviours. And that's the same as every neurodevelopmental and psychiatric condition that we know of. We diagnose based on what we can see, and that, in the context of autism, is the presence of social and communication difficulties, so language, and the presence of restricted and repetitive behaviours. And those are the hand mannerisms that we often see, the really routinised behaviour, the great attention to detail. So when we see those behaviours in a child, we start to provide the diagnosis of autism. Now, autism has certainly increased in diagnosis in numbers over the years. When I first started in the field about 20 years ago, we diagnosed autism in about 2,000 children. Now we diagnose autism in about 1 in every 60 or 70 children.
Wow, so that's a big change
over time. Yeah, it is. It's a big change, and there are a number of factors that are at play there.
Yeah, can you tell us why such a change?
Oh, look, certainly one of the major changes we've seen is simply our awareness of what autism is. Now, again, when I started 20 years ago, autism was really quite an unusual and unknown condition. What has happened over time is a huge amount of research that has helped us to understand it. Now, really what brought autism first to the public consciousness was Rain Man in the sort of 1980s, the film The Rain Man. But autism was first described in 1943, and so it does have a long history, but we really only started diagnosing autism once it came to the public consciousness, and a major contributor was Rain Man. And so what happened over time is that stimulated research, and we used to diagnose autism almost solely when a child had intellectual disability, so quite severely affected by autism. What we do now, however, is we understand that those core autism behaviours can be present when a child doesn't have intellectual disability. In fact, they might have lots of verbal language and have very high IQ. So that kind of expansion of the diagnostic boundaries of what autism is and the change in how we define it has really led to an increased number of kids being diagnosed.
Yeah, very interesting. Professor Andrew Whitehouse with me for Ask an Expert. We're talking about autism. So how is it diagnosed? And, yeah, I know someone whose child has the sensory form. What are the different types?
Yeah, look, we used to diagnose different types of autism, but actually for the last 5 or 6 years we don't. We put it all the different and broad array of children into that one category of autism spectrum disorder, the so-called spectrum. Now, as I mentioned, we diagnose autism based on the presence of those core behaviours of social and communication difficulties and restricted and repetitive behaviours. Typically, we diagnose autism in childhood because we tend to observe those behaviours very more frankly, more obviously, when a child starts to turn 3, 4, or 5. Actually, a lot of the research that we've been doing at the Telethon Kids Institute has actually found, and this has now been transferred across the world, that we can identify early differences, even in the first year of life, that might be indicative of a child going on to get a diagnosis of autism.
So what would you look out for in the first year of life, Professor?
Oh, look, all sorts of things. But really what we're looking at are those social and communication behaviours that are so critical to developing more advanced language. So things such as response to name, whether a child's pointing, sort of quality of eye contact that they have with people, whether they show other people things, whether they imitate. So there's a whole range of behaviours that we see. What we do in Australia is the average age of diagnosis is about age 4 to 5 years of age. And really what we're trying to do, one of the great research goals, is to ensure that people have a good awareness of autism so we can get that diagnosis age younger. Because what we know is that the brain is changing so rapidly in those first few years of life that if we can get in and support kids and families from the very earliest moment of developmental difference, the longer-term impacts are really substantial.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the other real important changes is that we've started diagnosing adults on the spectrum. And there wouldn't be a week that goes by that we don't meet a family who's coming with their child. And then the parents go, actually, now you mention it, these types of behaviours, I was like that when I was a child. And so we're seeing a huge boom in the numbers of adults receiving a diagnosis of autism as well. And so that's another thing that has actually contributed to the larger numbers of people on the spectrum.
That's so interesting. By the way, when you mentioned Rain Man, I thought of Love on the Spectrum, which I loved, the ABC series, which I think is now on Netflix.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, really good. And just celebrating their strengths as well. I've got a question for you from Paul in Perth, who would like to kick off the talk back. Hello, Paul.
Yep, hello. Hello, Andrew. How's it going?
G'day.
What would you like to ask?
Yep. Okay, very short background. I broke in 2020 and finally last year got diagnosed with both autism and ADHD at age 50.
Yeah.
But informally diagnosed, like according to grandma, I was concerned as a very quiet baby. But quick questions, main problem with adult I have is, if you've got an adult diagnosis and you're actually told you're level 2 because you've got crap at social skills, but also you're financially okay because you can do technical stuff, is it worth bothering with all the pain of NDIS, and are there any other local resources or groups which are targeted at people with both autism and ADHD, which hide each other well, but we still break?
That's a good question. What would you say to Paul? Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, it's a really great question, and thanks, Paul, for the question. There's a couple of things in there. The first thing, what Paul mentioned, is that some things that we do when we provide a diagnosis of autism is we provide levels. And so that's level 3, 2, and 1, with the idea that level 3 provides an additional description that this the person receiving the diagnosis needs support to a really high degree, whereas level 1 is to a mild degree they'll require support. So one of the greatest challenges in terms of autism is how to provide the best support so that beautiful child can reach all of their full potential. And, of course, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, the NDIS, is a really important supporting mechanism. As we've known, the NDIS is having some teething problems as it's starting to get moving, but it is going to be a massively important reform for our nation. So in terms of providing support for adults, there is absolutely able to provide support for adults through the NDIS. And the decision as to whether apply for the NDIS is really a matter for that person as well as their clinician that they're seeing to understand what are the supports that they may require and whether the whether the NDIS is the right avenue for that support, because there are other supports such as through Centrelink as well. So that's really a discussion for Paul and his clinician.
Yeah. And any resources for people with both ADHD and autism?
Yes, of course. Well, it depends on what resources. And so there are resources in terms of support groups. There's ADHD, WA, and there are a number around for adults on the spectrum within Western Australia. And they can be simply Googled as well as looked up through on Facebook groups. So there are a number of support groups which really do provide wonderful camaraderie for and a community, but also provide a really good way to identify ways to access support.
Okay, I've got a question here from Katie. Could you please ask Professor Whitehouse about the work of Temple Grandin? Who is that?
Absolutely. Temple Grandin is a veterinary scientist out of the US, and She was quite a severely affected child on the spectrum, and was, you know, told all of those things that we hear, those horror stories, never amount to anything. She grew up to really revolutionise in across the world how we care for animals, particular animals in particular circumstances. And for a child who was And she's a hugely charismatic speaker as on the speaking circuit in the US, but has really been fundamental in showing the strengths of all autistic kids, adolescents and adults, that no matter the barriers that are in your life and the barriers that you may have been born in, and part of that barrier has been born into a world that is not necessarily designed for you, just the extraordinary achievements that you can do, and part of those you can achieve, but also part of that is the exhibition of your amazing humanity. And that's part of her great achievement, is not just what she's done at work, but the demonstration of the value and the beauty of humanity to people on the spectrum.
I can see on the internet, further to what you're saying, there was a HBO series about her. Claire Danes played the part. Autism gave her a vision. She gave it a voice. Temple Grandin, what made her exceptional, was from about 12 years ago, and she was a prominent proponent for the humane treatment of livestock for slaughter. Wow, that is interesting. Thank you, Katie, for the question. Mitch in Yellingup has a different question for you, Professor. Is there any evidence to prove the triple antigen vaccine causes autism? I know people who say there is. From my limited research, it would seem there is not. What would you say to Mitch?
One word answer is no. Two word answer is absolutely not. And a more expanded answer is that there have been now literally hundreds of investigations seeking to understand if there is a link between particular types of vaccinations and children developing differently. It's important that people understand where this came from. The original link was proposed in a scientific paper of a very small number of children in the late 1990s. Now, that paper was subsequently found to be entirely fraudulent, based on fraudulent data as well as mired in financial conflicts of interest. And so because of that, that paper was retracted. Since that time, there have been literally hundreds of papers that have very clearly demonstrated that there is no clear link, indeed no link, between the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine and the development of autism. Just one example would be a study in Denmark where there was a study of over 500,000 children, and they examined the rate of autism in those children who had and had not received the vaccine, and actually there was a higher rate of autism. Very, very small, slightly higher, but nevertheless higher rate of autism in children who had not received the vaccination. And, you know, if there are any links, we would start to see them through these hundreds of papers, and it's been categorically debunked.
Good. Well, let's not give any more time to it, but good question though, Mitch. 7 minutes left. I'll read you this text here, Professor. It says, I was diagnosed at the age of 48, level 2 ASD. I'm a mum. 12 months after my daughter was diagnosed, I'm awaiting an ADHD diagnosis. How can I tell if my daughter may also have ADHD? Maybe not so much this question, but she does ask, why do a lot of people have both conditions, and what symptoms would I look out for in my daughter?
It's a really great question, and what we do know is that there is around 30% of people on the autism spectrum have or would meet criteria for ADHD. Now, ADHD is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and the idea that people have challenges with attention or inattention in this regard, but also show more hyperactive behaviour than we'd typically seen, and often seen to be driven by a motor is often the thing that we say. We see high comorbidity. That means these conditions often co-occur in the same person more often than we see by chance. What we do know is that there are genetic similarities in some cases. The genetics are very complex, but the genetic pathways are not too dissimilar, which is likely to play a role in that regard. Now the best thing to do in terms of monitoring clinically or identifying is to take from your own experience, understand what you identified in yourself, think about how that might actually play out in a 12-year-old girl, and monitor. And if you do have concerns or would like to seek support, then that is absolutely your right as a health consumer to ask your GP for a referral onto a specialist.
All right, 25 minutes past two. We've got 5 minutes left with Professor Andrew Whitehouse from Telethon Kids Institute. Geez, it flies, doesn't it? I've got this text here for you, Andrew. It says, "Hello there. Could you please ask the professor why doesn't autism diagnostic take so long?" From Charlie. "I'm 9 years old and might have autism. Thank you."
Yeah, thank you very much for that question, Charlie. Look, I agree. It's one of the greatest challenges of our health system, the time it takes to receive diagnostic assessments. Often the wait lists are extraordinary. Anything up to 2 years is something that I have heard recently, but often an average of 6 to 12 months from the point of referral to actually seeing somebody. That's simply a function of resources and resourcing, that we've seen a significant increase in the number of people who are requesting an assessment, and we haven't seen a similar increase in the level of funding to support in any way the numbers of kids and adolescents coming through. It's a real indictment.
The state budget is next week. What would you like to see, Professor?
Oh, we need significant investment in not just diagnostic services, particularly through the State Health Department, but also we need significant investment in identification and providing support to these kids and adolescents. I can't stress enough that diagnosis is a really important part of the journey for these families, but it's not the first part. The first part is providing support. Diagnosis can come down the track, but too often diagnosis has to come very much up front.
Yeah.
And that is the trigger for providing support. But we need to actually say we need to provide support sooner, and diagnosis can come down the track.
Yeah, I hope more funding is thrown at it. Such is the nature of a segment like this. I've got a whole lot of questions that have come in with only 3 minutes to go. Thank you, Charlie, for texting the program. Teresa says, "I have a foster boy who has been diagnosed with PTSD, at the moment getting diagnosed for autism or ADHD, but it appears to be hard due to his PTSD. Can you give me any advice?"
Yes, it's a really interesting a phenomenon, and it's a really tough one to convey the nuance. Certainly we do see a lot of children present to us with similar autistic characteristics, but not autism, and often they have come from a history of trauma or early neglect. And so that it's not necessarily autism, but actually the early trauma and neglect has led to developmental differences that often are very similar to autism. It's not an uncommon story, unfortunately, and it's probably one of the most hidden but important elements that we need to address as a health system, how we can best provide this and how we can prevent that that kind of early trauma and neglect, and how we can better provide support. So the best way is through the Department of Communities, assuming that that's what they're engaged in, to provide support. But if they are seeking better support, than referral through a GP to a specialist is the way.
Okay. All right. We've got time for one more. All right, let's go to Lance. I think we've got time. I'll bring him on to air. Hello, Lance and Geraldton. What's your question?
Yes, these diagnoses, the last quite a few years now coming up, I'm 67 and I can honestly never heard of all this DDHD or any of this type of illnesses or mental illnesses and so on. Back in my day, as I was growing up, you never... So how long have these being diagnosed been coming around? And maybe ideas of what's causing, whether it's metal, heavy metals in systems, or what may be causing this. I never heard of this type of thing when I was growing up.
Thanks, Lance. Joe also wants to know whether parents under the influence of alcohol at the time of conception could cause these things. So, I mean, what would you say to that question generally?
I'll be very, very quick because I know we're running out of time. Look, our awareness, the autism has been within the humanity pool since time immemorial because it's a part of the wonderful human diversity that we all exist in. What we have got better at is identifying and proactively providing support. That's the change. I'm now old enough to a little bit of the previous generation, and even in the generation that I grew up with 20 years ago, we certainly didn't identify, name, and provide support in the way that we do now. So it's a function of providing, developing proactive services to help kids and families who require support, and that's a really positive evolution. In terms of heavy metals and other potential influences in the environment, if there was low-hanging fruit in that regard in terms of causing a new cause of autism, we'd absolutely identified it by now, and we haven't. Yeah. The very strong evidence is that we're simply providing better support.
Yeah, very interesting. Oh, Professor, I am so grateful that you gave us so much of your time. I know it's scarce right now. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Christine. It's been great.
Professor Andrew Whitehouse from the Telethon Kids Institute and UWA, thank you for all of your questions.